more transparently. So this is what we had. And all I've done, I've just rewritten that now. We have our two identities up there for relating I to other things. If I eliminate I get this identity here. 2L is equal to 2 minus E plus this sum. That's, I've written it down here again. If I use that, if I group the Qs here, so there's a Q in the loop thing, and there's a, if I kind of write this as being M times Q over M, and pull this Q over M over here, then I'll have a loop factor which just depends on constants. And then the total power of Q over M now is this plus 2L. And if I use this to re-express 2L in terms of vertices and E, I get this power here. And so now you can kind of see more what I was talking about, that what you have here is 4, which is a positive, E, which is can be bigger than 4, but it's for any one graph, it's fixed. So if you fix, the issue is if you look at one particular amplitude, you're asking, if I look at higher and higher loop corrections to that amplitude, are they under control? And so E is not a dangerous thing because that's something which you're specifying once and for all for that class of graphs, and then you're asking for the corrections to it. So the rest of the stuff is telling you about how successive graphs are contributing to that fixed amplitude. And here you can see that what, once, the way I've expressed it now, the total power of Q over M, once we include the loop dependence, depends on the number of derivatives plus the number of powers of field minus 4. And so that number of derivatives plus the number of powers of field, that's the thing that is telling you the dimension of the interaction. If I had had the normalizable interactions are the ones for which D plus N is less than or equal to 4, because that's the, if each field is giving me a mass, then if I have N fields, I'll have mass to the N as a part of the dimensions, and each derivative is a mass, then each derivative gives me, D derivative gives me a mass to D. So D plus N is the dimension of the interaction. And so if this is bigger than 4, that's just saying that the coefficient, the coupling in front of that interaction should have been suppressed by some inverse power of a mass. So all the things for which this is positive are all the non-normalizable interactions in your Lagrangian. And so those ones are giving you positive contributions, and they're never dangerous, is what this is saying. The things that are that for which this is zero are the renormalizable interactions, the things like 5 to the 4th would have satisfied that n is 4, d is 0, so this is 0. If you had had a, if you'd imagined the kinetic term as being a perturbation, then that would have had d equals 2, n equals 2, and so that would have been 0. So that's also not a dangerous thing because it's not making this more negative. The things that are specifically dangerous here is when d plus n is less than 4. And so if your interactions are starting at the cubic order, something which is cubic in the field and has any derivatives at all is not dangerous because that's not d plus n is equal to, n would be 3 and d would have to be 2, so this would be 5 at least. So the only thing in an interaction, if it's an interaction, n is at least 3, so d equals 1 is not an option because that's not Lorentz invariant. So the only thing that's at all possible that's the problem here is d equals 0 and n equals 3. So specifically, cubic interactions in the scalar potential are dangerous. And those are the things that on dimensional grounds would have had a coefficient which is of the order of some mass. And so the way we've been counting those dimensions, that the scale, that if v and f and m are all large, we've been assuming that that coefficient is a big mass. And so that's why that big power of mass in the graph is dangerous for this low energy expansion. If you had assumed that the coefficient of the cubic interaction, so if we're talking now about a pi squared term, pi cube term in the interaction, and if this coefficient was a small mass, then I wrote that as being, the way I wrote that was f to the fourth, you know, pi over v cube times some constant c, which is dimensionless. If you think of this as being a small mass, then, you know, what's c? C is really m v cubed over f to the fourth. That's the dimensionless constant we're talking about. So I should think of that as being much, much, much less than 1 if I really had a small mass here. So in everything I did to this point, I've been thinking of these c's as being order 1. And so if you had had a cubic interaction where you had stuck a small mass in front of that interaction, effectively you've made one of these c's extremely small the way I've defined things. And so in this power counting, every time you insert that vertex, we should have kept track of the factor of c through the number of times that vertex with 0 derivatives and 3 vertices was in the graph. And that extra factor with this suppression would be the thing that compensates for what looks like a negative power here. But if you have an order 1 coefficient here, that is to say you have a big mass in front of this cubic term, then this is showing you that those things are dangerous You're destroying the low energy approximation when you insert them into loop. But it's specifically the terms in Lagrangian that have positive powers of mass that are the dangerous ones in the Wilson. And so anytime, so that tells you that if you're looking at a Wilson action and someone gives you an interaction which looks like it's got a positive power of mass in it, you should be thinking about that interaction carefully about whether or not it makes sense to have that in the low energy interaction. And that kind of is underlying many of the naturalness problems that are people talk about in literature. So that's what I was meant when I was trying to say, looking at this formula, that you only have to worry about things in the potential that have small powers of field. This is the step that I was relying on, that the combination of the loops and this thing combines to something which cares about both the number of derivatives and the number of fields, and it's only the ones that are super renormalizable, which have positive powers of mass in front of them, with order one coefficients when we normalize it to a big mass that are moving. So let me do an example, just a specific example, and then come back to the general statement. So for example, the famous, historically, this was first done by Weinberg, just power cutting with the Physica in 1979, and I forgot the exact reference, but if you expires Weinberg, it's the famous, this is what people call the Physica article. It's where he lays out this whole effective Lagrangian description in the context of chiral perturbation theory for the first time. And so the example he's looking at was for pions at low energies. And we'll see what low energy means in a second. The Wilson action for those, they're scalar fields, basically. The Wilson action for that turns out to be, these are, it happens that these things in the limit, the strong interactions, if you turn the quark masses off, pions become Goldstone bosons. There's a symmetry in the problem which is spontaneously broken, and there had to be a massless particle which carried whose interactions were suppressed at low energies, and the pions are them, it turns out. That's why those are the lightest strongly interacting particles, because that in the real world, quark masses are not zero. They're small compared to the other scales of the strong interaction. So that limit where the symmetry is there is almost a good limit. And so it's useful to think about the limit where the masses were zero. And the pions are not exactly massless, but they're almost massless, so they're lighter than everything else. And that's why their mass is 100 MeV, whereas typical strong interaction masses are like a proton, those are 1,000 MeV. All right, but the bottom line is that if in this limit, they have no potential energy because they're Goldstone bosons, and their Wilson action would have been some function of phi over m, v, let's call it, phi over what they call f pi times, I call everything f, so it's, let's call it f pi squared, some function which I'll call the g of phi over f pi, and derivatives of plus things with more derivatives. So the upside is that there's a calculable function here, which I'm not telling you what it is because it doesn't make a difference what I'm about to say. So let's call this, I guess we call this G2 for two derivatives. We have a G4. I over f pi, I over f pi. So you can have more derivatives, and so on. There's a derivative expansion of the Ezra's action that you can figure out. And what's important is that this first, what's important for the historical purposes is that, and for actual applications, is that this function g is completely dictated by the symmetry of the problem. The only unknown constant in this Lagrangian is f bar, so this part of Lagrangian. And this g is a non-trivial function. It's something which has a series expansion that goes never stops. It's depending on how you write things, this could be 1 over 1 plus pi squared over f pi squared. So some non-trivial function. But its form is dictated by the symmetries. And this is a similar thing. It has some parameters in it, but it's not dictated just by the symmetries. But there's an expansion like this that you could write down. And so I want to... What Weinberg's observation was that this... this power counting we can apply in this case. So this has the form of the Lagrangian we started off with. So it has the property there's no potential energy because these are Goldstone bosons. So d is greater than or equal to 2. What we called f and m and v are all the same in this theory, and they're basically f pi. And with that specification, there's a bunch of constants, these C's, that I never really made explicit. You know, Weinberg could have told you what they were, but they're not playing a role in the power counting I talked about. So if we apply that result to this case, everything simplifies because of this choice. So then what we would have found in that case would have been that we have all these things are just degenerating down to we have f pi to the fourth, 1 over f pi to the number of external lines. Our loop factor is now simplified because I'm going to write it in this way here. So we've got q over 4 pi f pi. For the length of the loops. And we have q over f pi to the 2 plus some so it happens that f pi is something like a pion mass, and they're all kind of in the ballpark of 100 MeV. Whereas typical strong interaction masses are like the proton. Typical hadron mass is the order of 1 GeV. And what this shows you is that supposing you wanted to know what the dominant contribution is to pion-pion scattering. Okay? So let's say take pi pi goes to pi pi. So we're taking E equals 4 in that case. So there's 2 in, 2 out. Then the amplitude becomes, you know, these cancel. So we just have q over 4 pi f pi to the pledge number of loops, e over f pi, 2 plus some e minus d d. Now d, there are interactions for which d is equal to 2, but there are none for which d is equal to 0. So this is always positive. And let's say we ask, what's the biggest contribution? What graphs dominate? This amplitude. So we're asking which are the ones which are least suppressed by Q. And so we ask what graph dominates this amplitude at low energies. Q is much less than 4 pi pi. Or f pi. So we get to choose the what we stick in the graph, and so first thing that we can minimize this factor by taking L equals 0. So the biggest is we take L equals 0. And then this thing is going to be, we're doing tree graphs. So now we have to ask kind of what kind of tree graphs can we draw. Given we're doing tree graphs, we have this factor of 2 for sure. All these things in the first, all the things involving G2 have B equals 2, and they have various powers of 5. So for all of those things, this is 0. But these other interactions with 4 derivatives and higher, they all have, this contribution is going to be non-zero. And the more interactions of them of that type you have, the bigger the power is. So the smallest this power can be is 2. And that'll happen if you use any number of vertices you like, provided that D is equal to 2. So use any V so long as D is equal to 2. So that means use only interactions from this cubical Lagrangian there. And for that choice, the dominant thing will be of the order of just the Q over F pi squared. So if we take, if we had written G out, so if G2 would have a piece which is, it would be 1, that'll be the kinetic term, plus say C2 pi squared over F pi squared, C4 pi squared over F pi squared. These are all known constants. There's like 6 or 3 over pi or something, which is calculable from the symmetries of the problem. If this is true, we're not told to prefer the ones with fewer powers of phi here, because as far as this counting goes, any vertex is equally good. And as far as the small thing in the problem is concerned, they're all equally contributing. But the requirement that we draw a graph that is only at tree level restricts which ones we can use, because we're drawing a graph which has 4 external lines, and we're allowed to only make tree graphs out of it, and those tree graphs can have 2 or 4 or 6, they can have 4 or 6 and so on vertices, but the one with this term here is just a kinetic term. So we have, what can we do? We can draw this graph. In principle, we could have drawn a graph like this. Let's say we had a term like that. So I guess we could have had it here. Let me say I had C1 pi over F pi plus C2 pi squared over F pi squared. Doesn't really make a difference. There's some series. Then we could do this graph other ways too. But then that's it, right? If I take something with four vertices in it, this is the only graph I can do. If I take it with 5 vertices, there's no way I can connect it to the external lines, because I've got a dangling line. If I take something with 6 vertices, if I connect these to external lines, somebody has to always be in a loop. So the fact that L equals 0 says that this is it. These are the graphs I have to calculate. The only vertices I need are coming from this term and from this term, and that's it. So if I was now in the matching business, given that I can calculate that these are actually determined by symmetry, C1 and C2 don't have to actually match to the underlying theory, which is good, because the underlying theory is a strongly interacting one, and we don't know how to do that calculation. Symmetries tell you what C1 and C2 are. All I need to do is figure out what F pi is. And so I could calculate F pi from some process. Typically, that's done with from pi on decay, because pi on decay depends on F pi. And so you, by looking at the pi on lifetime, you can read off what this value of F pi is. But once I've done that, I have a prediction for what pi on scattering should be to this order, as long as the energies are low enough. And so this prediction was discovered using other methods back in the 60s, and these are called the soft pi on theorems. The logic of them was that at low energies, pi on interactions are completely controlled by one number, F pi, which you can measure by matching to pi on decay. And then once you know that number, pi on scattering, and it could be 2 particle scattering, we could have asked for pi goes to pi, or E equals 5, and we could have done a similar argument, and we could have identified exactly what counts there. And the same argument would have shown that these 2 derivative ones are the ones we have to include, and the topology of the graph will only keep some finite number of terms in that expansion, and we're done. But so the leading thing is nice, but the power of this thing really comes in when you start looking at subleading corrections. You really understand an approximation when you know what the corrections are to the leading thing. And so so let's ask what the corrections are. This is a kind of the argument I'm giving now. When we get to gravity, will be this verbatim the same argument. The story about the two derivatives. This thing would have been the Einstein action, and so. If we had been doing gravity, when we get to gravity, the corresponding statement to what I just did would be the statement that the leading approximation, gravity, first of all, is a low-energy approximation. It's low energy is compared to some scale, and we'll know what the scale is in the gravity case by doing this exercise. And the leading contributions will come from taking L equals zero, classical physics, using any number of vertices from the two-derivative term, i.e. the Einstein term. That says that the leading contribution is classical Einstein gravity, which you're inclined to believe anyway. But the subleading contributions are the ones that you might not have known how to get systematically, and this will tell you how to get those, too. So the same argument I'm about to give in the gravity case will give you a similar statement. So the subleading, the first subleading terms. Well, the next biggest thing will be, because we always have even powers here, will be to, because d goes up in even steps, will be of order q to the fourth. So a bar e subleading will be of the order of q over f pi to the fourth power, possibly with f, with 1 over f pi, possibly with 1 over 4 pi, 1 over 4 pi squared. And how do we get that? Well, the way to get that would be, if we want to have a total of four powers of q, we could take this to be 0 and take L equals 1. And V unequals 0 only if V equals 2. Or the other way to do it is to take L equals 0, but allow ourselves now to have D equals 4, 1. V equals 0 for V equals 2, and V equals 1 for some interaction with V equals 4. So that tells you that the subleading approximation is we can do loop graphs using the same Lagrangian we've been doing classical approximation before. That's this thing. One loop graphs using the two derivative interactions. Or we can do classical graphs where we insert exactly once an interaction coming from these four derivative terms. And again, the topology of the graph will restrict the kinds of things we can write down in the same way that we did here. And so there's some fixed number of things you have to calculate. This thing is involving only things that you probably calculated already. You might have to use some more terms in this expansion here, so you might have more vertices. So for example, we would have graphs like this, which involve the same vertices that we've been using before. We could have had graphs like You could have graphs like this, which now involve six vertices, which we weren't using before, but are coming from Lagrangian, where it's all determined by symmetries. Or we could have graphs like this, where that vertex is coming from one of the guys in here. So something involving four fields, but four derivatives as well. But there's some fixed number of these things, and then you stop. And the point of this argument is that you can see that if you know how far you want to go in the series, there's always some fixed number of things you have to know in the Lagrangian, and it doesn't go on forever. And so I should wrap up soon. I'll give you the general pitch for the what you do with effective. You're now ready to have the general effective Lagrangian spiel. And the way you use an effective Lagrangian, like if someone hands you a Wilson action, what you do is you say, well, I want to know an answer. Typically, a Wilson action will not be renormalizable. It has all possible powers of fields and derivatives. Traditionally, people would have said you cannot use that kind of a Lagrangian in a loop calculation because things will diverge. You'll have to renormalize those divergences. That will involve renormalizing all possible things in the Lagrangian, and you have to then. That means you can't. You have to get those the values of those the renormalized couplings by comparing to some experiment. But because you had to renormalize an infinite number of times, you have no predictions because everything you calculate you're using to learn a new parameter. You're not predicting anything new. And the fallacy in that argument was this, is shown by this, that was like thinking that you wanted to work to infinite accuracy in some small ratio. The scale, the divergence was really the sign of a heavy scale, and it was not infinitely large, it's a finite size. So if you, the real way to think about a non-normalized Wendt interaction is to appreciate that what you're really doing is a low energy approximation. It's always some low scale divided by some high scale. That's what's controlling your approximations, including the classical approximation. But once you appreciate that, you can say, well, supposing I want to know my answer to an accuracy of 1% or 1 part per mil or 1 part per micron, 1 part per million. Then, since I know what these scales are, in this particular case, the pion mass, 4 pi f pi is about 10 times bigger than the energies that a pion has when it's not moving very fast. And so this kind of ratio is of the order of a tenth. If I want to know the answer to a 1%, I need to work to quadratic order in that ratio. This tells me that that's the first leading term is as far as I have to go to the accuracy I want to know. So the only interactions I need to know are these ones, and then I'm done. And so I can predict them because the only parameter in that problem was f pi, which I can get from the decay constant, which is different. So there's a finite number of things I need to know to make the predictions for that order, the accuracy that I need to know here. If I want to do better, I need to know more things, but it's a finite amount of more things. If I have to stop at this order, then there's a couple more interactions I need to keep track of, but not an infinite number of them. And once I've calculated what those coefficients are by matching them to something, everything else I calculate to that order is a function of those things, and so I get to make predictions. And so the power, predictive power of a non-renormalizable theory is to treat it like a Wilson action and to think that what you're implicitly doing is a low energy expansion. And to ask, now what controls that expansion and how far down that expansion do I have to go for the accuracy that I'm interested in? And to any finite order, you have predictive power. It's just the farther you go down the expansion, the harder it is because the more things you have to keep track of in the accuracy. That's probably the question.